Together we will stand, fight until fall. Come on now, people, let's get on the ball and work together. Come on, let's work together.
Do it, children.
Now, now, people, say now, together we will stand. Every boy, girl, woman, and man.
Good morning. And welcome to Neighbors on KUMD. It's a new feature we've created to give us an opportunity to talk about these challenging times in which we live, take a look at some of the issues, some of the good things going on in the community. If you are having conversations with people over Zoom or Skype or, you know, the old-fashioned telephone or maybe social media, you know that folks are interpreting information about COVID-19 and the best way to go forward, depending on how these things are affecting them. How can we think about them? How can we start to unpack this so that we can have a better understanding of what we're dealing with here? Dr. David Beard joins us this morning. He's an associate professor of rhetoric, scientific, and technical communication at UMD. Hey, David, good morning, and thanks for being our guest this morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So as we try to look at what is the greater good, issues of the economy versus people continuing to stay home, we know that those efforts are making headway against the spread of coronavirus, but obviously it's not sustainable over the long haul. So is there any way to get close to an objective measure to weigh these two competing interests? How do we start to think about these things?
One of the great sources of tension, I think, when I talk with people about these issues is this notion of when can we go back, right? The employees want to go back to work, right? And they absolutely do. They need that financial stability in their lives. We need them to go back to work because we want our food supply to be sustained. But I think that using that kind of language frames part of the problem. They don't go back to work if going back to work means going back to the way things were before. I have so many friends who are passionately checking every day the Minnesota Department of Health statistics page because they're looking for the magic number that somehow will click in their mind that says, okay, now we can go back. Or they're looking at the unemployment statistics and they're thinking, well, now we've hit the number, which means we have to go back. And I think one of the first things we need to start thinking about is that framing puts us in the wrong mind altogether. We don't go back. Whatever we're going back to is going to be different, and so not going back at all. When we're talking about what needs to happen at that meatpacking plant, we're not sending them back. We're changing the conditions under which they work so that they can continue work safely and in a new way. Does that kind of make sense?
Yes, absolutely. Obviously, it's comparatively easy to judge people who say, I want to see a movie or I want to get a haircut, because as a society, we deem those as frivolous pursuits and people should be more concerned with looking after one another and staying home. And yet there are people whose employment depends on those activities. Part of it is to say we can reopen, but only if we're doing things differently.
Differently. Absolutely. If you think of it, what a lot of people are looking for metaphorically is a kind of checkered flag. When we've crossed the checkered flag at the end of the race,
exactly,
we can go back, right? And there won't be a checkered flag. Even people who speak about, waiting for a vaccine, I'm not even sure that that really is the checkered flag that we are hoping for in this particular situation. And if you don't get that checkered flag, it's hard to decide what to do next. I often metaphorically think about I moved to Duluth 15 years ago, and it took me a very long time to get used to April. And what I mean by that is this,
you're from southern Minnesota, aren't you?
Wisconsin, Milwaukee.
Oh, okay, yeah, I hear you. Uh-huh. I understand exactly what you mean.
in Milwaukee, spring just happens. And
yes.
Here, it happens, and then you get a foot of snow in the middle of it, or what you thought it was.
And
right?
Then it unhappens.
And, yep. And in a certain sense, The experience of coronavirus is like the experience of April in Duluth, right? Part of us is waiting for that surge to come, right, that will both threaten to overwhelm our healthcare system in the same way we're waiting for that last blizzard in some Aprils. And in some Aprils, it never comes, right? And in many ways, I think you pull yourself out of really negotiating where you are now if you spend your time stressing about that blizzard that hasn't come yet. Does that make sense?
Right.
And instead trying to figure out, okay, where am I right now? What do I need to do right now to adjust my life to the weather that's happening in this moment?
I grew up with parents who were alive during the Second World War. My dad served in the Second World War. And hearing a lot about what life was like in rural America during that time, and also what life was like in small town America or Minnesota at that time. There was this sense of everybody being on the same page, everybody being really cohesive. But it feels like we're starting to drift away from where we were even a month or 5 weeks ago. This idea that we're bringing back some of these World War II things, victory gardens and baking bread and that kind of thing. We're already splintering off. Yeah. How are we different from the way we were 80 years ago, 70 years ago?
Well, I mean, one of the things, this is, it's a remarkable gift to be in this position, right? To be in a position where we feel free to have these kinds of disagreements is showing that we haven't suffered the kinds of struggle that they suffered with, right? The kinds of sacrifices they needed to make to support the war effort in terms of giving up material goods and to support war production. We haven't suffered the kinds of medical crises. There's a miraculous way that because the surge has been minimized in Minnesota, we have the time and the space and the mental energy not to think about questions of survival, but to go back to some of the divisions that I think were essential to our political and social life 7 months ago. So my first impulse is to say, I'm grateful that in a certain sense we aren't suffering in a way that pulls us together, because I'd rather we not suffer that way.
That's an excellent point.
I think then the larger question becomes, okay, so if now we're in the position where having not had to suffer that way, we can go back to those divisions, how do we go back to healing those divisions? And that becomes a question that this country's been involved in for at least 3 years, I think.
I read a fascinating article about that. And I at the moment, I've been reading a really whole bunch of fascinating articles lately, and I'm trying to hang on to them so that I can go back and revisit them. But this had to do with the idea that as we look at some of these inequities, Americans have kind of this naive hope that, I think the example used in the article was that maybe rich people are going to be acting differently once this is all over.
Mm-hmm.
And the author of the article was basically going to, the author of the article was obviously saying, kind of naive, no, this is not going to be some magical change of heart that's going to happen. This is magical thinking is not called for, action is called for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and similarly, the idea that when this is done, we will have revalued the work of our grocery store employees.
Right.
That we will have, it would be wonderful to imagine that that's possible. I don't feel that in my bones, but I guess that's not really a critical reflection. That's more of a personal response.
Do you think that some of these divisions are going to blur from now on? I mean, do you think that there can be, with a lot of these things, there hasn't been any pushback? You know, we don't really pay attention to grocery workers. So when somebody says, grocery workers, whatever, there haven't been these conversations. So nobody said, no, wait a minute, grocery workers are essential. Are we going to at least have some of these thoughts in our heads going forward?
I hope so. I would feel that we'd be doing a great disservice to people who regularly risk their safety and not their lives to help make sure the food supply remained intact. Out of respect for the gifts that they've given us, I would hope we retain that. But going back, I guess, to that sense of comfort that we're experiencing right now, I worry very much that not having had to suffer, we will not retain the memory.
Well, and let us hope, certainly, because I don't, I wonder if, I have not looked at the maps recently, so I'm not exactly, you know, you could sort of see the surge coming in particular from the East Coast and moving this way. Yeah. And I did hear a doctor interviewed who said people who want to open everything up, they feel that way because it hasn't been real to them. They haven't experienced. This was a doctor from New York City who said they have not experienced what we've experienced. It is not real to them in the same way that it is to us. And if they have experienced what we have experienced, they would not feel that way about it.
Absolutely. I mean, in many ways, if you think about some of the framing in colleagues with some of my politically different friends, has been very much that the idea that the precautions we've taken have been about preventing deaths, right? And so it reveals a fear of an aversion to risk, which feeds into some larger political ideologies. And that's not what we've been doing. We've not been hiding from death by locking down or staying at home. We've only been attempting to slow the extent to which it overwhelms our medical system. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And to the extent that people don't have a full sense of that larger picture, right, that this isn't about being afraid of catching this disease. It's about being afraid of what happens when this disease overwhelms your hospitals and puts your caregivers at risk.
Right.
And means that people suffer unnecessarily simply because we couldn't stay home. If people don't share the same motivation for the sacrifices they're making, and you're right, they don't share that same motivation because it hasn't felt real to them in the same way, they haven't seen those consequences, then it will be harder to retain the consensus that we need to move forward to get at those larger questions and divisions you've been pointing to.
One of the things that I began the show with is the idea that I said to myself, I need a philosopher. I'm not the only one who needs a philosopher. UMD is collecting some materials about living with the virus and understanding how the humanities, of course, including philosophy, can help people understand what we're experiencing. And it's more than just critical reading of what it is that we're being exposed to on social media. There's a lot that goes into this, and you're working on this National Endowment for the Humanities grant right now. Can you tell us just briefly what that could do, what that could be like?
Well, this is a remarkable confluence. The library began their archive that's active right now, and every one of your listeners can go to the Martin Library website and make their own contributions of photographs and stories and of their life during the coronavirus. But because of the kindness of our federal government in producing a stimulus plan that includes a plan for incorporating the humanities, UMD is applying for funding which will basically take our recently unemployed library workers, some of our recently underemployed journalists, some of our other recently employed unemployed arts administrators, and pull them together to collect the stories of the community in an oral history project. If this project is funded, we'll be able to send them out into the world and seek the stories of people's experiences, not just hoping that they'll bring them to us, but to go out and seek them in a way that both collects the stories, but also, more importantly, participates in that government project to put people back to work.
KUMD is pleased that we have already been approached by the library for our entire catalog, if that's the right word, of coronavirus coverage to be included in the archive. So, yeah, we're feeling pretty proud of ourselves about that. That's going to be wonderful to be a part of that. David, thank you so very much this morning for joining us. We have one of your colleagues that you recommended to us, Dr. Devalina Das. She's an assistant professor with Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies. She is going to be our guest this morning coming up. David, thank you so very much for taking some time to talk with us this morning. What a treat.
We really
do need more philosophers, and we need more of them on the radio, in my opinion.
Thank you so very much. It's wonderful to speak with you and your audience.
Oh, I get by with a little help from my friend. I get high with a little help from my friend. Gonna try with a little help from my friend.
This is Neighbors. on KUMD, an opportunity to have a conversation about the interesting times in which we find ourselves, find out what's going on in the community, how folks are coping, what folks are thinking about, what kinds of work they're doing, studying that they're doing. Of course, an academic, highly academic community, a lot of folks are taking the opportunity to put these times under a microscope for one reason or another. If you'd like to take part in the conversation, 218-726-7181. Dr. Devalina Das joins us this morning. She is an assistant professor with Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies. And Devalina, thank you so much for joining us this morning. What a treat to have you with us.
Thank you, Lisa. It's absolutely my pleasure. I'm honored.
I read the little bit of information that David, who we just spoke to a moment ago, sent me about your work, about the effects of solitude on the body at this time. And I guess I was thinking about how many more animals I tend to have sitting on me at one time or another. And I was thinking about how occasionally they get a little stir crazy and they're bouncing off me. And I thought, I don't think bruises are what she's necessarily talking about here. Let's back up just a step, because I took a look at some of the fascinating work that you're doing already with regard to bodies and mm-hmm. how bodies present themselves in the world and what we think about people depending on bodies. Is there a way that you can kind of talk about that in layman's terms to kind of help people understand a little bit about what kinds of work you'd already been involved in before this?
Sure. Thank you, Lisa. You know, one of the main challenges being a person from academics is, I think, academicians need to think how we could take the research and the studies that we are doing as meaningfully to the community at large. And therefore, I think the current research and my research area that I'm working, I think I want to bring this to the community, where I primarily work in a field called narrative medicine and body studies, where I try to analyze stories of disease, healing, just to make it communicable compassionately to people at large and make them understand a disease in a body or an illness in a body beyond charts, numbers, or graphs. And this also includes kind of what are the bodies that are undergoing stress and anxiety, especially from the healthcare workers' perspective. So my focus here in my research is, what is the importance of this body to maintain a culturally and economically healthy society? How we human beings embody ourselves. And sometimes on the basis of our bodies, we try to differentiate and, you know, create inequalities. But the primary thing is, we need to honor, we need to respect each body. Those are different, vulnerable. And in that way, we can maintain a healthy society.
So with that in mind, one of the things that you're looking at now has to do with the effect of solitude on the body. And I don't know if David was using, if he specifically chose the word solitude deliberately, or if could he have substituted loneliness, because those are two different things. Is solitude the word that you would use?
Well, I think solitude is a privileged term for some of us, but it is not same for others. So I try to differentiate these two terms, physical distancing and social distancing, because social distancing is not same as physical distancing. Those who are equipped with technology are privileged. They can still have that solitude and can try to find out ways, but not everybody is privileged to have that. But when you are talking about in terms of solitude, I think it is not a term which is applicable for everyone. For example, our, you know, senior citizens who need support, for those who are homeless or low-wage workers, you know, these individuals, I think, for them, solitude is a kind of sometimes unreachable thing. So I will prefer, you know, selectively using the term solitude for some and isolation for others and loneliness for other groups.
So what are the things that you are finding about solitude, about the condition of being physically distanced? And how are you finding, I realize it could be early days, but how are you finding that these things differ between solitude, isolation, and loneliness?
Yeah, it is so fascinating. You know, my case studies, my analysis is, as I say, it is based on stories and real life, you know, narratives rather than just data and charts and numbers. So it is so interesting to see, like, in this crisis time, for example, when we are unable to hug each other, when we are unable to kiss, how we are trying to supplement that. So some people are trying to listen someone's voice, see someone's picture, or someone is cooking a food and keeping it at someone's door. And in that way, you are trying to, you know, feel the kind of the wholeness, the being, the touch through the taste. So I think that is a kind of a solitude where you can still find out ways and enjoy and try different meanings of living life. And loneliness, on the other hand, I think is for people who are, I mean, for our students, for example, for individuals, you know, immigrants who are cut off from their families, I think loneliness is more challenging, where you cannot reach out to a particular community through technology and you are isolated. Loneliness, I think, is also possible when, look at our kids, our children, who are unable to have that sense of community when they are playing on the ground. So it cannot be substituted by, you know, video games or computer games. So I think these are all different areas based on where we, how we are situated in the community, what privileges we have.
There have been a lot of studies about the effect of long-term stress on people, and I'm not exactly sure, because I'm not a doctor, what doctors or therapists consider long-term stress. In the short term, everybody I talk to talks about how they're they've been eating, they've been self-medicating with food. A lot of people are actually, you know, they're having fun. They're enjoying cooking. They're enjoying experimenting with things. Some people are doing what I'm doing, which is just mindlessly shoving stuff in my face. Let's talk a little bit about some of these longer-term effects of stress, because any step out of our kind of, you know, comfort zone, our routines, is stressful to folks. Sometimes it's super stressful, sometimes not so much.
That's a great question, Lisa. You know, as I'm talking to my friends and colleagues and family members, they are saying, like, well, the message is go out as less as possible in the crowded areas. But on the other hand, if you stay at home, you feel like cooking more and going to the grocery store and things are finishing, so I want to bring and try different things. So I sometimes feel that, you know, when we are trying to eat more in this kind of situations, just binging or, you know, other kind of activities that we are engaging into, sometimes they are an expression of different forms of stress. But when you are talking about the long-term stress, I think one of the key challenges in that long-term stress is, you know, when things slowly open up, do we hug? Do we embrace? And, you know, how do we carry our body in the society? And this whole concept of 6 feet distance, it is a part of the stress. Are we carrying the tape every time to measure that we are maintaining 6 feet distance or not? So it is. It would be interesting in terms of our psychological and emotional challenges as we slowly open up. And if we open up, do we still continue wearing masks? Are we always remaining conscious every time if we are putting our hands on our eyes and face? Are we keeping every time measurement of the distances that we are maintaining? So I think we will need a lot of therapists. We will need a lot of sharing of discussions and a way of healing through a community process, actually, by sharing all our stories and engaging into all these discussions. It cannot be healed just by a medicine. It cannot be healed. The vaccine can, of course, when the vaccine comes out, it's going to help us to prevent the virus. But the emotional stress that we are going to have, it will require a lot of other cognitive process.
It will be interesting also, again, this is just one of these things that David and I had talked about just a little bit ago. With some of these situations that have always existed, there are people that have lived an isolated life. And now All of a sudden there's all of this focus on it and all of this conversation about it. And a lot of people are going, oh, this is horrible. This is horrible. And people have been going, well, yeah, but it's been my life for quite a while. And It's does anybody care? Is society responsible for trying to help fix it? Is it how do we deal with that? Will we have increased compassion and an increased awareness and an increased sense that we need to reach out to one another more or not?
Yeah, I mean, this very sense of quarantine, I think there are different forms of quarantine we already practiced in different ways, and technology helped us. For example, the work from home culture, it is not something which is new that has suddenly appeared during the pandemic, but something which people have already started long time back as technology came in. And then there are other forms of, you know, isolations and separations for people who have been living in solitude at completely, they want to stay away from the city life and they want to live in a remote countryside. So I think even those who live in the remote countryside, or those who have been working in solitude, working in isolation, there had been always a community that has existed, or they have found out a community, a different meaning of a community in different ways. The basic bottom line is that we are human beings. We live for a healthy living. We live in a way that keep us communicated with the world around us, with our human beings, with the animals, with the trees and the plants. And so I think keeping everything in place, technology, yes, it is necessary. Those who want to live in solitude, yes, we need to do that, to respect that. But at the end of the day, community matters. The spirit of togetherness matters, and people find out different ways to, you know, figure out that.
Dr. Devalina Das joins us this morning. She is an assistant professor of women, gender, and sexuality studies. Devalina, thank you so much for joining us this morning. What a treat to have you on the program.
Thank you so much, Lisa. It's completely my pleasure to be here. And I'm happy that I'm able to, you know, share my voice to the community. Thank you so much.
This is Neighbors on 103.3 KUMD.